I don't want to take from Africa without giving back to Africa. Youth Quake Nation is part of our ethos, is this giving back, not taking without returning, because that's what's needed. And it's very rare, has been rare in the history of the world.
Hey, y'all. Welcome back to the Fast Forward Podcast. I'm so excited to continue our discussion called World Opportunity. And today I have somebody, see, this is why I pay to be nosy, y'all, because I met this gentleman being nosy at a restaurant, nosing around on his plate and what he was eating. It ended up meeting somebody who has been an incredible, I would say, mentor and friend, just a wealth of knowledge. And I'm so happy that you all get to hear his wisdom as well. I knew that I could not do a conversation about global opportunities and business development without having George on the podcast. And you're going to see why in just 2 seconds. So, George, please introduce yourself to us and tell us about you.
Kaylin, it's a pleasure to be on this podcast with you. You quickly became one of my favorite people, just sniffing around on my plate. We had such a great conversation, and it's turned into a great, great relationship. I'm George Land. I am CEO and founder of Youth Quake Nation Sports and Entertainment. This has been a venture that I've been in for about a year. Prior to that, I spent 31 years with the NBA. I was an executive, senior vice president, 3 different places in the world. I spent the first 20 years of my NBA career in content. In New York and New Jersey, did some amazing things, worked on a show called NBA Inside Stuff. I was a producer for that show. Just recently got inducted to the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame. We have our Hall of Fame rings, Kaylin, to show for it. We also did The Last Dance, and I was a producer behind the scenes. When Michael Jordan was in his last year with the Bulls, it's on Netflix now, and we won an Emmy for that. And then 2012, I moved to China. The commissioner at the time, David Stern, asked me to help grow that business. We had some ideas about how we could use content to grow the business. And so I moved my family, 2012, to China. We lived there for 7 years. And then as we were coming back to the U.S., the next commissioner, our current commissioner, Adam Silver, is a dear friend, asked me to come to Africa and do something similar, help build the business, help grow the brand, help, you know, bring basketball to as many people as we possibly could. So I did that for 5 years and you know, still make my home in Africa.
You said it so, like, succinctly. But I wanted to like geek out a little bit at several points, because the boldness that it takes to create something so special in New York and New Jersey. And by the way, NBA Inside Stuff is still like the stuff of legends. It's an incredible, incredible legacy that has been left on not just sports, but entertainment as a whole and culture, and how we show up and create the intersection between sports and entertainment. I think so much of how the NBA has become more approachable and relatable and touchable is due in large part to the way it has leveraged content. And to be honest, the NBA has done it in ways that other sports have not. Right. Like when I think about basketball, basketball is one of the most approachable sports in terms of feeling connected to it and it being a part of just your everyday world. And so it's so exciting to hear the outsized role that you played in really bringing that to life. So that's important, first of all, but also to be able to pioneer work on 3 different continents that have drastically different cultures themselves. Can you tell us a little bit more about that process? Because in order to do that, you have to bring you to the table. So what parts of you did you use and lean on to create that global impact in three very different geographic locations?
Yeah, no, thank you. You know, it's very interesting. The U.S. part was just, it was really just about the love of basketball and us trying to, our commissioner really did believe that telling our stories of players, as you said, you can connect with our players. It's, you know, one of the reasons is our players don't wear helmets. And even in baseball, they wear caps. And, you know, it's hard to even know a lot of these players. Only you only know the very famous ones. But in basketball, you're intimately, you have an intimate relationship with the players on the court. You can see their faces. We have great guys who play the game and great personalities. So it is inviting. And so to tell those stories helps a generation. What we did with Inside Steph, we told their stories, but we also highlighted what they like to do off the court. And, you know, it really connected with a generation of players. LeBron James and Kobe Bryant, these guys have all told me that it was Inside Steph that really got them hooked on the sport, because it was, at that point, it was a show that was ahead of its time.
Yeah.
As I moved into management and thinking about the business broader, I did have this idea that content, again, is the connector. And China was our largest market, you know, outside of the U.S. And we really weren't curating content. We were sort of sending things over. It wasn't localized at all. It was just content that we were doing in the U.S. and letting them use it on their, you know, our partners, their networks. My idea was that if we localize the content, if we really start to curate the content for the people in the market, we'll have a much better chance of hooking a generation of Chinese viewers. Now, basketball is already the number one team sport in China. So that was something that we had going for ourselves. But, you know, I think it's really underestimated, I think among my circle sometimes, how hard that whole process of moving my family. First, there's a professional and then there's the personal, right? And so I moved my family to China 3 days after Christmas. So, and my kids were 9 and 7. They just turned 9 and 7. And so literally 3 days after Christmas, we were on a plane to China, got to China. We dropped these kids off, you know, in the middle of this Shanghai city, which is 24 million people. And we all had to adjust. You know, it's the middle of their school year. They left everything that they knew, family and friends. And so, and then obviously there's a language barrier. There's a culture barrier. There are all kinds of barriers. It couldn't be more different, East and West. So one of the things that, you know, to your question, I had to understand how to cope. I really had to understand that I'm the outsider. Even though I was the senior vice president and supposedly the expert, we had an office there, NBA China, and we had an office in Shanghai and Beijing. And what I quickly understood is that I need to learn. I need to keep my mouth shut for a while and really understand what's important to my, you know, to my new team and to my new colleagues. You know, there's an old proverb that says, you know, he who thinks he leads and has no followers is just taking a walk, right? And so I didn't want to be in that situation. And so, look, I really took time. I took about 3 months to get to know people. There's an element of trust that you have to gain. Again, I'm a foreigner. I'm an American. I'm a Black American. And I don't think that there were that many around. So I think people had to understand who I am. And so once we sort of got past that, then we were able to sort of galvanize together because, look, we all wanted the organization and the business to do well. And one of the things that we did very quickly was we collaborated with CCTV, which is in the state, you know, network in China, government owned. Everything's government owned, obviously, but this one is much, much government owned. And we created a show. We created a 2-hour show that aired in primetime on Thursday nights, and it became the number one sports show in all of China. And it stayed that way for 7 years. And we did that in our first 3 months there. And what that did, Kalen, is it gave our team, it gave our sport, and it gave me credibility. Because after that, because it became so popular, we were able to quickly do a $500 million exclusive deal with Tencent to air our games. And that fundamentally changed our business. We were never again really in financial, you know, peril once we did that deal. And right before I left, we did they renewed it for $1.5 billion. And obviously those two are the largest deals ever done by any sports league outside the U.S. And so I feel very proud that the content that we created together was sort of the driver for that. It showed what localized content, what content where you think about the recipient and what they want, and tailoring that content to that group. It's amazing. And we connected with the audience very well.
So much to draw from that. Let me try to unpack it piece by piece. Number one, as a person, the level of cultural humility that you display cannot be understated. Because I think, you know, in business, especially in corporate, it's like, oh, be culturally competent. But competence still assumes a level of authority and dominance that isn't true or helpful in building relationships. So your ability to cultivate your own cultural humility to say, yeah, I know what I know, and I'm grounded in myself. I don't feel like I'm less than, but I'm new here and I'm not the authority on this culture. I'm not the authority even necessarily in this business yet. I'm the authority in what we have done and where we're trying to go. And being able to involve the team is so important, because I think especially for a lot of leaders, power, right? Like how you harness power, wield power. Oh, I just want to come in and make noise. No, sometimes you actually need to come in and be silent and be quiet and observe and involve rather than control, right? The decision to be quiet is often more powerful than the decision to control. Because the decision to be quiet is really the decision to control yourself rather than controlling others. And that's where a lot of us get tripped up. So that was an important first thing that I pulled away from what you said. Another important thing that you mentioned that I want to highlight is, you know, a lot of us talk about like blue ocean strategies where we want to enter new markets and we want to go do these new things and we want to get away from what everybody else is doing. But in order to make that happen, you have to get early wins. So when you're entering a new market and you're trying to do something grand and there are political differences, maybe than how you're used to interacting in other countries, or there are differences in culture. If you don't secure that early win, number one, your team becomes demotivated. So they're like, okay, what are we working on? If it takes us 18 months to get anything done, what's the point of this, right? But it also creates more space for competitors to capitalize on what you can't complete and what you can't succeed at. And then finally, it also creates more and more space for mission creep. So you all being focused on the fact that like, hey, we want to grow the NBA in this market and we're going to use content to do it. So let's get some good content out. Like that is the win. That clarity of mind makes such a huge difference. And I think as business owners and business leaders, we're not always clear on our strengths and almost like je ne sais quoi. Like what is the thing that you do so well you could knock down a quick win to get some points on the board? Like how fast can you do that? And I love that you all were able to do that, because that win then was able to compound, grow confidence, grow excitement, grow presence, and then grow money. we focus on growing the money first, but a lot of those other things have to come before we can really touch that.
Yeah, no, it's true. And, you know, one of the things I do remember is that right before we moved from New Jersey to Shanghai, Hurricane Sandy hit.
Mm.
And it was pretty devastating in New Jersey. And so we didn't have lights for about a week. And I remember I was writing that show by candlelight in my home in New Jersey so that I could have something ready to present to the people of CCTV. And look, you're absolutely right. To be able to be humble is, especially in China, like, it's key, because you really do have to build relationships.
Yes.
And I was only supposed to be there for 3 years. This was a 3-year contract. And it was going to be 3 years and out. I was an expat in and out. We started having so much success in content and in other ways. And my team was strong. I had good people with me. I enjoyed working with my colleagues there. My family was happy. We were very happy. That 3 years turned into 7 years. We had no plan for that. That wasn't the idea. But it was... it was the greatest because we were doing really good things from an organization standpoint and from what our mission was, which was to create content. Because first and foremost, we are a media entertainment, you know, NBA is a media entertainment organization. That's what we are. And so to be able to take the game and then create content from the game then allows for all the other things. It allows for marketing, allows for business development, you know, allows for all these other parts of the business to do events and things like that and community service. So it was a very important time. I call it the golden years in China. There were a lot of other expats in Shanghai, met a lot of great people, a lot of good friends, but we did some fantastic work. And I will always think, you know, back fondly on my time in Shanghai.
I'm so happy to hear successful expat stories, because I think especially now you either hear like one or two directions, like people move to another country and they're like, I hate it, I gotta go back home now, or they almost have like an exploitative mindset about it where it's like, oh, I'll be over there and there's so much here and da da da. But for you to have integrated into the culture, respected the culture, and also saw opportunities to grow the presence of the work that you're doing there while respecting it, I think that's an important point to highlight for listeners, because it doesn't have to be one extreme or the other. And you don't have to be there forever. You can decide, I want to be there, and where I'm going to be, this new country, continent, place, city, wherever, I want to make a positive impact. When I leave, I want it to be in a better position, more expansive. I want more people to have access to dot, dot, dot than when I came. And I can also know that I'm going to have an expiration date for when I need to leave. And both of those truths can coexist. And I don't think we always recognize that. Like, I see what people talking about in the social media streets, and I'm like, no, that I don't think that's the right perspective.
Look, I think I was lucky. First of all, my mentor was David Stern, and he believed in international expansion. He believed in China. And so when I came up with this idea and presented it to him, he was floored that I would even consider, because no one had really done that. We had had a guy who was there. Our CFO was there already because we were making a leadership change, and he was there. But he stayed for 3 years. You know, I was there for a long time, and I was lucky that I had David and Adam, who was a deputy at the time, to be able to think about how this would look for me. I also had a wonderful woman named Carrie Chandler, who was, she's HR. Maybe you know her, maybe you've heard of her, I'm not sure. But Carrie had been an expat as well. So she knew sort of the challenges that we might, as a family, have moving to China. She had lived in Hong Kong when she worked at Disney. And so she really created, she and David really created a package, you know, for us that eliminated sort of all the other stuff and allowed me to focus on my job and the kids to go to school. And that was really part of the beauty of our time there. It wasn't just these benefits. They were benefits for a reason. And that was to make sure that we were comfortable because we were doing things that others weren't doing. And, you know, there are challenges. You have your kids growing up in China, and my daughter is really cute, really nice head of hair, but she couldn't figure out why her hair wasn't straight and black like others, right? And so, always being different.
Yeah.
Always being different can take its toll. I think, you know, we all got used to it and we had to work through some things sometimes, but it was sometimes difficult. And then the other piece is you learn how to, one of the things that I learned, Kaylin, is because you don't speak the language. Like I didn't speak Mandarin. Fortunately for me, my kids became fluent at the time. My wife was fluent. I was focused on work and I'm not as smart as they are. So I couldn't pick up the language like them. My daughter's still fluent. She's great. But for me, because I didn't understand, I had to depend on someone to tell me what was being said in the room. And then I had to depend on someone to say to others what I was saying. And I don't always trust that. It's just no one can say it like I want it to be said. Words have meaning and there's a language chasm. So I was always very concerned about that whole process, you know? And so one of my superpowers that I picked up though is how to read a room and how to read body language. It's like when you lose your sight, maybe your hearing becomes stronger. For me,
you depend on another sense. Yeah.
My sense was my ability to perceive and to see what was happening in the room. I could look around and see who was, you know, my ally. I could tell who was not. I could sort of tell what was being said, even when I didn't understand the, you know, all the details of what was being said. And it has propelled me for the rest of my life to now. I'm still able to, it's a skill. And it's an important skill because it does allow you to sit back and to listen. And to read and to have empathy and to have some emotional intelligence about what's happening around you. And I think that's one of the things that I learned very quickly. And I think it's one of the most important things that allowed me to have success internationally.
So much again. First of all, I love that, especially as a man, because I think as women, you know, we call it our woman's intuition and things like that. And it's much more accepted to be able to talk through that and own that superpower. But I love when I hear men own the fact that, like, yeah, I could pick up on things and I listen to my gut. I listen to what my intuition is telling me. I listen to my perceptions, because not only does it save you from calamity, it also helps you to capitalize on moments. So when I can find the ally in the room, I can know, okay, I'm going to look to that person so they can be the nod, because maybe they have more influence than me. If I know, okay, my detractor is sitting over there, they don't look like they feeling it, let me make sure I highlight this point because I think that'll get them to buy in. That is such an invaluable tool in business. And I'm happy that you use the difficulty of the language barrier to hone that. Sometimes we look at difficulties or things that potentially could be, you know, a handicap for us, and we lean into that and just say, well, I can't, well, da, da, da. No, like, you can transmute that issue into being your benefit if you work it right. Another thing that I love that you talked about for both your personal and professional life, the difference between independence, interdependence, and codependence, right? And so for a lot of us, when we're looking at global opportunities, we think that we need to be hyper independent. But, and some of it's cultural, because that's just how America is. It's very individualistic. You should, you know, figure your own stuff out, pull yourself up by the bootstraps. But that independence can work against us because, number one, it could be inefficient, meaning it takes us more time, sometimes more money to get stuff done, and is wasting energy. But then it also stops us from building key relationships. And so I'm happy that both your family and you with your team, you were comfortable being interdependent on one another, leaning on the benefits that were available to you through your job and through your ecosystem, leaning on the support of your team, building closeness and intimacy as a family so that you grow together and figure things out together. I think that's hard for a lot of people because we condition ourselves so much to be like, well, I have to figure this out. I have to do this. I have to be on my own. And that's not true. You can identify the problem as an individual, right? Like it's your issue to fix, but it's probably going to involve other people's strengths and other people's resources, time, love, care, concern to be able to get you past the issue so you can still be productive and successful. And I don't think a lot of us capitalize on that nearly enough.
Yeah, I agree. But one of the trappings about, you know, being an expat or being, you know, in a satellite office or an office in the market is that you can become detached from the home. And when I left New York and New Jersey, I was in the room. I was in the room for almost everything. And that was, I love that. I could understand how decisions were being made. I could understand the debate. Sometimes it's not just the decision, it's about the debate that happens about it, which is very, very important. And so when you're in the room and you have that understanding of what that debate was, then it gives you a better perspective of why the organization makes, you know, certain calls and things like that. As I got to China, and I always had great people to support me in New York and New Jersey. Supervisors all, you know, were high on me. I was always, you know, thought to be an exemplary, you know, employee. When I moved into the markets and for the 11 years, basically that I was, you know, away from New York, I became more and more detached. Because you are sort of running a business or helping to run a business that's in a market. The person who may be running the show in that market, that's not necessarily the person. They didn't hire you. You were brought in, right? And so there's no history. There's not a lot. And, you know, I'm also a different nationality. And so the connection is different. And so what I had happened to me over the longer I stayed away and the longer I wasn't in the room and the longer people weren't interacting with me on a day-to-day basis, the less connected I became also in the States, to the point where, you know, not sure that everybody always knew all the things that I was doing and how difficult it was. And honestly, I wasn't asked a lot. Things were going well. Right. You know, when things are going well, people just sort of assume that everything is okay.
Exactly.
And so, you know, but what happened over time was I became more and more disconnected to the home base, to New York. And I also didn't have the supporters that I was normally used to.
Okay.
And so it just became a little more difficult. It was gradual, but, you know, sort of by the end, and it's one of the reasons why I left, you know, the NBA. Look, 31 years is a long time any place, and it was that time. And I always knew that my time would come. And the organization has been around for over 75 years, and we survived the greatest commissioner of any sport ever. And Adam took it right on, and we didn't really miss a beat, you know? And so I know that the brand and the organization is bigger than one person. So I always knew that, you know, my time was going to come.
Yeah.
But what Jason did a little bit was sort of this lack of connection that I had and sort of starting to feel like I was in the middle and just sort of wanted to do things differently and have more direction over my life and how the decisions that I wanted to make from a professional standpoint, I wanted to have those myself.
So that, of course, leads to the conversation of your time in Africa, which especially leads to what you're working on now and your own venture. And so I don't want to speed past NBA Africa at all, because I definitely want to talk about that, because I think that's super important. But I want to maybe fast forward to now and then dip back just a little bit. Like, you know, on the old VCR, when it was like you could hit like skip 10 seconds, 20 seconds, or you could just go back a little bit second by second. Let's go back second by second after we come.
Okay. Well, listen, I can sort of tell you how it happened.
Yeah, because I think, and I'll tell you real quick why I love that transition, because wanting to do things your own way, that's how I became an entrepreneur. Like, when you see the need and then you're like, I'm cool with the outcome, but the methodology, I feel like I got something to give the world there that I'm not able to do there. So yes, tell us more about that, because I want to hear about that.
Yeah, well, look, I got to Africa, I'll just tell you, and I was sort of doing more of the same. Like, I was doing, it was comfortable. I was able to, you know, by the time I left China, I was overseeing marketing and events and basketball operations in addition to content. So when I came to Africa, which NBA Africa was a lot smaller, fewer resources than NBA China, we needed to build those up. I oversaw those things, plus communications and PR and social responsibility. So I had a lot on my plate, but I always knew, but I always knew that the Africa job with the NBA was going to be my last job with the NBA. I don't like going back. It's something about returning to something that that doesn't inspire me.
Totally understand. That's all I can say. Yes.
I don't want to go back. And so I knew that this Africa job was going to be my last with the NBA. And one of the reasons why I took the job was it was going to allow me to learn a whole nother market. And I always wanted to understand Africa. I always wanted to live and work in Africa for a finite amount of time, I thought. And so the mission of what we were trying to do in Africa, which was, you know, have kids play basketball, have, you know, try to bring content across the continent, which is way harder than in China, where it's one country and it's one, you know, communist country where, you know, if the president says, hey, or the minister of education says, we want to put a basketball curriculum in our school.
That's it.
All eighth graders have to do basketball as a proficiency in order to go to high school. By the next month, that's what's happening, right? That's what's happening. And then your sport gets a huge lift. But in Africa, as you know, there are 54 countries and all kinds of, you know, different dialects. But that means 54 governments. That means 54 ministries of sport. That means 54 ministries of education. So it's just very difficult. But the mission itself, the objective itself was something I love. I love kids. I love business of sport and I love basketball. And so it worked for me, right? It worked for me. So when I decided to leave the NBA, I knew that it was time for me to go, but the mission wasn't complete. And I wanted to be a part of the solution, because the African continent is always a second thought, unless there are resources involved. And so our kids, our people, the sport has every right to be as great as anywhere else. And so the reason I started Youthquake Nation, it's really, Youthquake is a word. The woman from Vogue in the 60s, I can't remember the editor's name, but she coined it because there was a revolution that was going on in the U.S. with the young people, rock and roll and the hair and the fashion. And so Youthquake actually means any significant change that's driven primarily by young people, whether it's a social change, a cultural change, political change, and in our case, an athletic change, a sports change.
Yeah.
And so that's why we're called Youthquake Nation, because on the continent of Africa, our median age is 19. Half the people are younger than 19. Half the people are older. In the U.S. is 38. In China, it's 38.
Yes. Yeah.
So the youthquake is happening, and it's happening here in Africa. One out of every four people in the world are going to be African by 2050. And so there's this incredible workforce that's growing right now.
Yeah.
And so to be part of that, to be able to help build capacity, to help, you know, build bridges to other places, because like it or not, Africa's not going to be able to maintain, just from an industrial standpoint, there's going to be too many people for the amount of jobs that they're going to have here. And so, you know, I think of myself as a global citizen, not just an African-American or American or African, you know, I'm a global citizen. And so it's all connected. And so I was really excited to start this organization to think about how we could be a solution to strengthening the sports ecosystem, how I personally could help young people who are talented basketball players, who are also smart young people, have opportunities. You know, let's face it, the basketball opportunities are mostly in the U.S.
Exactly.
Especially at the highest level. So how do they have access to that? You know, every other place, most places, you think about the U.S., we have kids who play, you know, in these junior rec leagues, and then they play in high school, and they're good, they play AAU, and then they go to university. In Africa, there's no such pathway. There's not a university system. There's no pipeline.
That's a good point. Yeah.
There's nothing for them. So, you know, to find a talented young person from the Central African Republic, which is right in the middle of the continent, and it's landlocked and sometimes at war. How does that talented kid find his way to, if he's a great basketball player, how does he find his way to, or her way to the United States to capitalize on their talent, which is an amazing talent? And so that's how I think about what we're doing. That's how I think about, you know, bringing, you know, business to business opportunities, so that, you know, the federations and the athletes here can be supported in a way. It takes money, it takes effort and time. And so it's bigger than, you know, just Youthquake Nation and what I'm doing. Yeah. But I like to think that what we're doing is significant and impactful.
I love that so much, because a lot of times in business, we see problems and we see opportunity, but you have quite literally built a solution, and you were able to do that because you have a track record of building solutions. And I think sometimes as entrepreneurs, we miss that important part. Like, and I'm even talking about myself. Like, I see the work that I do, I see my background, but do I really see myself as a solution? And then how do I communicate that? And I love the fact that you don't just see it. It's not just revenue, right? And especially now in this culture of entrepreneurship that is driven so much by like big tech stories, because tech has just taken over the entrepreneurship lexicon. We see money, right? Or just like these hard quantitative outcomes. But what you're describing, yes, obviously it's a numbers game to make sure that kids are able to get in the pipeline, they get the skills they need, it takes money to do the investment. That's cool. But also the qualitative benefits of knowing that as a kid, my talent doesn't just have to go nowhere. Not because I'm not talented, not because I haven't worked hard, not because even my community is supporting me, but just because there's no pipeline. Like, there is no path for me to go somewhere to do something with this. And you are solving that big missing chunk of like, hey, communities can prepare the talent. The NBA can create a league on this continent, but who is the middle person to build the connection, build the relationship, build the programmatic lines necessary to make this a reality. I think that's really powerful. And I'm excited to see it because it's not exploitative to either side. It's not exploitative to African people, nor is it exploitative to this industry and to the NBA, which has built itself on being the place to go for quality basketball entertainment, right? That can't be understated. And so you're able to bridge those two worlds. I think that is like so amazing. I really do.
So yeah, look, I think one of the things, I choose my talent, my basketball talent very carefully. I only have 8-9 clients. And I don't really want much more than that. Because their personalities and their value system means a lot. Yep. Because typically, you know, our African athlete wants to give back to his community. So, and I love that. Your point, I don't want to be exploitive. And I don't want to take from Africa without giving back to Africa. And so being able to
say, well, oh my God.
To be able to help, you know, a young person achieve their goals and even financially achieve their goals, and then be able to help the next 100 kids to be able to maybe follow in their footsteps or at least see what's possible, to see success. That's never far from my clients' minds. It's certainly never far from mine and Youthquake Nation. It's part of our ethos is this giving back, not taking without returning. Because that's what's needed, and it's very rare, has been rare in the history of the world that happens, right? And so I always tell my clients, look, I've worked a lot of years, and I've done fine. And yes, this is a business. A business is designed to make money. But that money can be, it's not a bad thing, right? The money is needed to operate. And the more money we can generate, the bigger we can operate and the more impactful we can be. What excites me, and I say this humbly, is that I know my clients have someone that they can trust. And it's someone that's gonna take advantage of, because it's really tough for an African athlete to pick up and not see their family for years and to move to the US and to try to play a sport at the highest level and not have support, not necessarily understand everything that's going around them, and being able to just feel comfortable. And so that's one of the things that Youthquake Nation, me, my team, so we try to provide so that no one's taken advantage of, and that they're able to reach their goals and be comfortable with reaching their goals and have someone that supports them. So, you know, typically, you know, the agency world is a young man's or young woman's game, a young person's game.
Yeah.
For me, I think what I bring is this stability.
I was about to say grounded wisdom. Yeah.
Wisdom, you know, and I understand the game. I don't need from them. What I need from them is to be the best that they can be so that they can then provide the opportunities to go back and help others and pass it on.
This is just like so heartwarming to hear, because, you know, I've had other conversations this month and we talked about just how much history impacts the way you show up in global business. And I think sometimes we think we can outrun historical issues, and we can't. And we have to have such intentionality as business leaders and business owners in the way we run our business, not because we are shady or it's not something we could do, but because the perception and the historical context of something would make it way worse than it is. And so the history sometimes of how sports representation has not always been mutually beneficial, the history of the way African talent and resources has been exploited without mutual benefit, the history of the ways in which, you know, people leave incredible careers and go out on their own and go on the warpath. You've been able to defeat all three of those things by being clear on who you are, knowing your purpose, and being clear on your solution. And I think that, is so important, because for a lot of folks, entrepreneurship is like their path to retribution, or their path to revenge, or their path to, you know, getting everything they missed in their in-house career. And it doesn't have to be any of those things. Like, you can't run a business with integrity. You can't run a long-term successful business. You can't run a business that people trust if your heart isn't in the right place about how you're showing up. And I can appreciate how intentional you are about that, because you have the track record of already doing it. And like you said, you can show up as George because you've been George the whole time. Like, you don't have to put on, you don't have to be anything other than that. And then that impacts your clients, because that becomes the model of them knowing, oh, I can be that too, because George was like that, right? And so what I'm hearing is that the cycle of mentorship. So you had amazing mentors, you've been mentoring others, you were doing what you needed to do as a business leader, and now your clients get that. So that will have an outsized impact on their communities, because they've seen what mutually beneficial investment looks like. And that makes me proud. That makes my heart smile. It really does, especially because it's effort.
And then the other piece, which I'd be remiss if I left out, is my personal side. I family, my immediate family, my wife, 30 years, and my children, who have been super flexible in moving around the world in order for me to do my job. You know, the sacrifices that everyone has made for me, but then also the support that they've given me always. My kids, even when they were young, but now they're grown, the support that they have given me, and the support that my wife, she's my rock. You know, I'm always thinking, you know, like, if there's a big decision, she's involved. And she helped me make one of my biggest decisions when I was a producer, and management asked me to join them. But I would have to leave producing. I'd have to, you know, producing was fun. I was producing, you know, Michael Jordan and Shaq and all these great people. And so I was trying to figure that out. And one of the best pieces of advice my wife said to me was, "Oh, that's great, but when decisions are being made, do you want to be in the room, or do you want to be outside the room waiting for the decision to be told to you?" And really, that gave me complete clarity of what I wanted to do, and honestly, what I'm good at, you know, managing people, and being a part of a leadership team that can lead and that can guide, that can manage. You know, there's a difference between a leader and a manager.
Yes.
Ones can do both. You can lead. Right. And some people are just leaders and they're not very good managers.
Yep.
And so my intentionality was always to be both. And so it allowed me to grow, really sort of change the trajectory of my career and my life. And then obviously having the guts to pick up the family, when no one really understood why I would leave my comfortable existence in New Jersey working for the NBA, why I would want to be uncomfortable and move to China at a time when nobody was there.
Yeah.
Really knew what was happening there. You know, it changed our lives.
I have to comment on that. And part of this is because my dissertation research looks at the experiences of Black men in corporate America between the ages of 45 and 60. And
I love that work, by the way. I love that. I love that you're doing it. I'm sorry, I'm a little bit outside.
No, I'm fine. Thank you. It means a lot. And I'll tell you why, because just what you just said, we don't often hear your voices. like from you. We see data about y'all. We, you know, see these random stories every now and then, but it's usually talking at Black men. And I wanted to give a voice to Black men. And exactly what you just said is exactly what I've been finding in my research, which is that overwhelmingly the men who feel the most satisfied in their career, who feel the most confident in taking big leaps and risk, taking on risk, they have supportive families, typically a partner, their kids, they have mentors, they're confident in their skill sets, right? Like they have all of these things lined up. And I think that that is so important for other Black men to know that that's possible, because a lot of people don't know that that's possible. A lot of people don't think that it's possible. I mean, you look at social media and it's a mess right now, especially. But the key, you know, your wife's advice, first of all, I'll tell your wife I said thank you because that just helped me. Thank you. But knowing that you have a partner who has your back, knowing you have a partner who can see a spark in you that maybe you weren't acknowledging, right? She saw like, hey, you're an incredible leader. You're an incredible manager. You need to be here. That's good that you're doing this. But I also see this spark. We need that. And I think that goes back to that, like, independent, interdependence, codependence. We need people to see things in ourselves that sometimes we haven't acknowledged or aren't brave enough sometimes to admit and step into, or sometimes that we just, you know, you want to hang on to the thing that you already know you love. And I can appreciate the fact that your family has been so consistent in supporting you, because that level of groundedness contributes to how you're able to show up in the market. Like most of the folks, and I'm thinking about in my own career, the people who had terrible home lives, they were like unhappily single, unhappily married, the kids didn't like them, they would be on the warpath at work. Like you hated to see them coming because you already knew what time it was. Like they was going to make everybody like a living hell. But the folks who had like a satisfied life where they were intentional about building the personal life they wanted, yeah, they could be totally comfortable showing up and being good with people at work and in their business. Why? Because they had no reason to put that type of negativity out in the world. So yeah, kudos to your family so much, so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Kayla.
Yes.
Journey.
Okay.
Let's get going. Yeah.
Final, I'll say final thought. What advice would you give to professionals who are considering taking that leap into building their own business and their own solution? And I say that because obviously in the current economic turbulence, really worldwide, a lot of people are like, you know what? This job might not be as stable as I thought, or I've been wanting to do this for a while. Maybe I should jump out on my own. What advice would you give them about how to What advice would you give them? I'm not even going to lead the question because I know it's going to be a good answer. So I'm not even going to give a little suggestion prompt.
I would say, first of all, every situation is different. And, you know, people's situations are different. And it's not a one, you know, fit all situation. You know, some people need benefits and need sort of the benefits that organizations can provide typically. Even though the job stability might not be great. What I would say is, what drives all of this is your own inner passion. And you have to find your constellation. I call it my constellation, my four stars, you know, and you have to find what those things are. And for me, it was, you know, it was international, it's youth development, It's business and it's sports. And, you know, if you can find all four and you're not able to get that in an organization where you feel where your mission, your personal mission, your professional mission cannot be reached, then it's certainly time to think about how you do that. Because we all have, you know, we all have passions and we all have, I think, you know, a place in this world. And you really have to think about what it's going to look like I always say, don't jump too quickly. Make sure that you know how, you know, as much as you can do. And it's what you do, Kaylin, is you do a lot of research. Yeah. And you try to figure out, you know, everything about what you're trying to do and if it's feasible or not. And then sometimes you have to be honest with yourself to say, well, this may not be the time, or it's something I want to do, but really it's not really a business. And so you have to do the work. You have to do the work. But once you do the work and then you have that passion, and then you can figure out how you're going to make money, because money is important, especially if you have a family, you go for it and you don't look back, and you tap into all the relationships that you possibly can. People will typically help other people. As long as the agendas don't clash, people want to help. I think people typically want to help. You got to make it easy for them to help. It can't be too hard. They can't have to work too hard to help you. But if you can figure out how to make it easy for someone to help you, and that your agenda doesn't clash with theirs, then you will find a number of people who are willing to give you advice. Don't be stubborn. Take all the advice you can. Not every advice is going to be applicable. But, you know, the more advice you have, it's just data points, really. And then you have to be one to discern which ones really apply to you and which ones mean the most. But it can be done. Listen, I was institutionalized for 31 years working in a big organization or a medium-sized organization. If I can make that move at the point in my life that I did, I think, you know, most people can do it. It just takes a lot of hard work. The other last thing I would say, Kaylin, is do as much as you can on your own sweat equity. Like, you're going to have to put in the work in a lot of different phases, things that you don't even, you know, that you're not familiar with. I mean, it sounds very simple, but I had been on a PC all of my life. Yep. And then when I left the NBA, I got a Mac.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was the deal.
Look, you ain't never going to look back.
But it took me a minute, right? Like, and it was just another thing. And I had an assistant for 20 years, right, who really sort of kept my schedule and made things easy for me. And all I had to do was think about sort of the strategy. I didn't have to worry about any admin. I didn't have to worry about any sort of the, you know, what happens if my, you know, computer freezes. And so all of a sudden, I had to deal with everything. But, you know, when you're an entrepreneur, that's what you do. And you don't want to give away in your company too early, because
thank you.
You gotta build it, and it takes work to do it.
I tell people all the time, I'm like, bootstrapping is the way to go for a while. Again, we get so wrapped up in this tech stuff where folks handing out $100 million. No, learn every part of your business. Like I tell folks all the time, I'm not a master at every functional area of my business, because that's not my skill set, but I know how to do everything I need to do for my business. And that helps me to be a better leader when I do bring on vendors and team members and things like that, because I can show them exactly how I would love it executed in my company. And it saves us a ton of time. And then I transfer it over to them to execute a task, and they put their special sauce on it, and that's cool. But it starts with me having clarity of mind. And I think a lot of us do rush to outsource or delegate things too quickly, and that slows us down. Like, it's totally fine to be a solopreneur for a while or run with a very small team, unless you know that the people on have a mindset to bring order. And it's so funny we talk about this, because I have to tell my startup clients this when they're bringing on, especially HR and operations leaders. I'm like, there is a different mindset of a person who is the pioneer, who can stand up the foundations of something. There is a difference between a person who can strategize on being able to take something to a new phase. And then there's a different mindset for the people who maintain what has already been built. And there's a place for all three. But if you need a maintainer, don't hire the foundation person, because they're going to be bored out of their mind and they're going to find problems. or create problems because they need to feel like they're fixing chaos. And I'm like, you have to know where your business is oriented. And probably the best way to start that is just doing it yourself. Like, you'll see quickly where all of the gaps are. You'll see quickly where the, you know, biggest problems are, where if I plug this, it'll have an outsized impact on fixing other things. But you are absolutely right. Like, knowing your business and doing your business is an invaluable asset.
Kaylin, you're such a treasure, and you're such an expert. And I mean it. You're so switched on. And I'm very happy that I have you to support me, to reach you if I have any questions and things like that. You're an amazing person. I appreciate this podcast so much.
Thank you so much. This conversation, I know, is going to help so many people, especially for, again, just that younger generation, especially for younger Black men, because I hear the conversations. I'm a part of them. I coach them in house for my, like, corporate clients and government clients. And you have answered some questions that I know for a fact many of them have, because they brought it to me. And so them being able to hear it from a successful, kind, like, thoughtful man, I'm excited for this. So on that note, listen, y'all, in the comments, tell us, what is the biggest nugget that you've taken away from this? How have you been making leaps in your own career? What leaps are you considering? And how can you harness the past successes that you've had to take that leap? Of course, be sure to like, share, and subscribe. George, thank you so, so much for being here again. I knew y'all was gonna love it, y'all. I knew I had George on. I already knew what time it was. So it was never a question for me. So, of course, y'all be sure to catch us in the next one. And yes, I will see y'all soon. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.